Today is Tuesday, March 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. At least three protesters are killed in Myanmar as calls continue to grow for the military and police to ensure that the right of peaceful assembly is fully respected.
Photos on Facebook showed the bodies of two men lying on the streets in the northern town of Myatchina.
Plus, the Belarusian opposition leader is in Switzerland this week to drum up international pressure for President Lukashenko to resign and a year of the pandemic. We'll have these stories and more next. Three more protesters were killed in Myanmar on Monday. This as shops, factories, and banks are closed in the main city of Yangon as part of an uprising against the country's military junta. Reuters' Lauren Anthony is up first.
Photos on Facebook showed the bodies of two men lying on the streets in the northern town of Myatchina. Protesters say they were taking part in a demonstration when police fired stun grenades and tear gas at them. Several people were then hit by gunfire from nearby buildings. It was not immediately clear who fired on the protesters, although both police and the military were at the protest. A military spokesman and local police did not respond to calls asking for comments on the latest incidents. The UN say security forces have killed more than 50 people to quell daily demonstrations and strikes against the February 1st coup. The generals say they acted because an election in November, which saw Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy secure a big victory, was marred by fraud, a claim rejected by the Electoral Commission. In Yangon, shops, factories and banks were closed as part of the uprising against the country's military rulers. At least nine unions covering sectors including construction, agriculture and manufacturing have called on all Myanmar people to stop work, to reverse the coup and restore Suu Kyi's elected government. Allowing economic activity to continue would help the military, quote, as they repress the energy of the Myanmar people, the union said in a statement. State media also said security forces were present at hospitals and universities. The International Physicians for Human Rights Organization said occupation of hospitals was a violation of international law. The United States and other Western countries have imposed limited sanctions on the junta, and the European Union is preparing to widen its sanctions on Myanmar's armed forces to target businesses they run, according to diplomats and internal documents seen by Reuters. Australia on Sunday cut defence ties, saying it would only deal with non-government groups in Myanmar.
Reuters reporter Lauren Anthony. The United Nations once again called for Myanmar's military and police to ensure that the right of peaceful assembly is fully respected and that demonstrators are not subject to reprisals. UN spokesperson Stephane Dujarric.
The Secretary General himself, as you've been asking me, is following the developments in Myanmar very closely, notably in the Samcheong district of Yangon, where hundreds of peaceful protesters have been barricaded inside residential apartment complexes for hours. He calls for maximum restraint and urges for the safe release of all without violence or arrests. Many of those trapped are women who were peacefully marching in commemoration of International Women's Day. We again call on all to respect the rights of freedom of assembly and expression of the people in Myanmar as they demonstrate peacefully and express their hopes and desires for the future of their country. Last note on Myanmar, our humanitarian colleagues tell us that the situation in the country remains dire and that aid operations have been disrupted by the coup. More than a million people identified at the beginning of the year are as needing assistance, including more than 350,000 internally displaced people still need help. Our humanitarian partners across the country are making all efforts to resume life-saving activities, but the operating environment remains difficult.
Belarus opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya is in Switzerland this week. The visit is part of her plan to drum up international pressure on President Alexander Lukashenko to resign and negotiate a peaceful transfer of power. Lukashenko was re-elected for a sixth term in office on August 9th in an election that has widely been seen as fraudulent. Lisa Schlein has the details.
Tikhanovskaya says she will be pressing her case for greater support for her country in her meetings with the president of the Swiss parliament and with officials of UN and private agencies involved in human rights issues. She says conditions in Belarus continue to deteriorate. Currently, she notes, Belarus is holding 207 political prisoners, more than 1,000 criminal cases are pending, and more than 55,000 people have been detained throughout the past months for protesting against the government. She says people in jail are being subjected to torture, rape, and other atrocities. She is calling for the release of all political prisoners and detainees and for perpetrators of crimes to be brought to justice. She is appealing to the United States, the European Union, and other countries to put more pressure on Lukashenko to leave office and end the suffering of her people.
It's up to every country if their values of democracy are just words for the country, or they want to make these words into actions. It's a challenge for all democratic countries just to prove that human rights is not just only words for them.
Tikhanovskaya says she's in contact with U.S. officials and received a strong message of support from President Biden after his election. She says she hopes to arrange a visit to Washington sometime soon. While she expresses disappointment in the Kremlin's support for Lukashenko, she says Belarus has close ties with its Russian neighbor and that will not change. At the same time, she says she sees signs of disaffection emerging toward the regime.
Putin supported Lukashenko after the elections, but now we see that Lukashenko is becoming like too expensive for Putin politically and financially. And I'm sure that they would prefer Lukashenko to step away.
But she hastens to add, whatever changes occur will happen through peaceful means. The UN Human Rights Council is in session and is expected to adopt a strong resolution on the crisis in Belarus. Tikhanovskaya says she would like the resolution to create a strong group of experts that will monitor conditions in her country and keep world attention focused on the critical situation in Belarus. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
France may soon join a handful of countries with laws aimed at repatriating stolen money and assets to their countries of origin. But anti-corruption watchdogs say the draft legislation needs changes to ensure the revenue doesn't go back to corrupt leaders. Lisa Bryant has that story.
A luxury townhouse on Avenue Foch, one of Paris's chicest addresses, is caught up in a years-long legal battle between France and Equatorial Guinea. The African nation argues the mansion is part of its diplomatic mission. French prosecutors claim it's owned by Théodorine Obiang, the wealthy son of Equatorial Guinea's longtime leader. So far, France is winning. A Paris court fined the younger Obiang millions of dollars and handed him a suspended prison sentence. The reason? The court said he plundered his nation to finance his luxury lifestyle, a sentence upheld last November by the International Court of Justice in The Hague. French authorities have also seized the 100-room Paris mansion, along with other property, including a fleet of luxury cars. Equatorial Guinea is appealing the case, and France's highest court is expected to examine it shortly. If France wins again, the millions of dollars in assets would normally end up in its public coffers. But a new measure making its way through French Parliament may change that trajectory. If it becomes law, the millions would instead head back to Equatorial Guinea, targeting its majority poor population.
This is the money that was stolen from people that work hard in their country, people that really need this money, and then we need to make sure that it will go back in those countries and use it properly.
Deputy Hervé Berville of the ruling La République En Marche, or LREM party, is helping to sponsor the measure, which was passed last week in France's National Assembly, but still faces a Senate vote.
It's really important to really tell our citizens and the citizens of the world on, in those countries, in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, then France and other countries will not allow like dictators or son of dictator to take money that they not their money.
Anti-corruption groups praise the legislation, but they argue some of the language needs strengthening now rather than later, as Deputy Belvide promises. Sandra Cossard is director of French NGO Sherpa.
For us, the legislation is not completely adequate to what we were expecting. And especially it's lacking this principle, which are for us, you know, mandatory. That should be transparency, accountability, and also very important, the close participation of civil society in all of the countries involved.
If it becomes law, the legislation could affect other high-profile cases underway here. Among them, that of Rifat al-Assad, uncle of the Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad. A Paris court sentenced him also to prison last year for money laundering and misappropriating public funds to buy luxurious French property. He, too, is appealing his conviction. And the family of conflict-torn Yemen's late president, Ali Abdallah Saleh, targeted in yet another so-called ill-gotten gains investigation here in France.
L'imposition unilatérale du choix des locaux par un état accréditant.
The Obiang trial is years in the making. It started with legal proceedings by Sherpa and fellow anti-corruption watchdog group Transparency International that also targeted the leaders of Gabon and the Republic of Congo. Equatorial Guinean rights activist Tutu Ali Kanté, who fled violence in his homeland 25 years ago, is following the Obiang case closely from North Carolina, where he now lives.
His family, for 40 years, for four decades, have ruled a country as if it was their own private fiefdom, without any accountability. So the fact that the French have gone as far as taking this case to the Supreme Court, it's very meaningful.
Ali Kanté hopes a final French conviction of Obiang and a new ill-gotten gains law will warn other corrupt leaders from poor countries they could pay heavily for stealing from their people. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken has proposed a series of steps to help jumpstart Afghanistan's stalled peace process between the government and the Taliban. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby.
What we want for Afghanistan is as a political settlement to end this war in a sustainable way. And there are diplomatic efforts ongoing and have been ongoing. Again, everyone's mindful of the deadlines and the effort right now is very much still in the, on diplomacy, on trying to get to a negotiated settlement here. But there's been no decision made about future force posture.
The Biden administration continues to consider a full withdrawal of the roughly 2,500 U.S. forces in the country by the May 1st deadline negotiated by the Trump administration. In addition, it was announced on Monday that the United States and South Korea have reached an agreement in principle on a new arrangement for sharing the cost of the American troop presence there, which is intended as a bulwark against the threat of North Korean aggression. Jury selection began on Monday in the trial of Derek Chauvin. He's the Minneapolis, Minnesota police officer charged with second-degree murder and manslaughter in the connection with the death of George Floyd. The AP's Amy Forlitti.
Chauvin is the officer who can be seen on that widely circulated bystander video. He's pressing his knee onto George Floyd's neck as Floyd says multiple times, "I can't breathe." Jury selection in this case is expected to take at least 3 weeks, and jurors will be brought in one by one for questioning. Those people who were selected to be part of the jury pool have already been sent out a lengthy questionnaire where they were asked everything from their prior contacts with police, their views on police brutality, their opinions on the Black Lives Matter movement and other protest movements that have been going on. And in the end, a total of 14 jurors will be picked to hear the case. That will include 12 people who will actually deliberate and 2 who will be chosen as alternates, and they will be called into deliberations only if needed.
AP correspondent Amy Forlitti. Before COVID-19, the United States considered itself one of the best prepared countries in the world for a health crisis. The pandemic proved otherwise. 1 year into the crisis, more than 500,000 Americans have died, and Steve Barragona has this story.
By early May of 2020, the United States had the largest percentage of people sick with COVID-19 of all the G7 industrialized countries. 1 year in, no one else is close. And the United States is third in deaths by population.
America's public health resilience has been shown to be an utter failure with COVID-19. You know, we're the richest country in the world and the poorest performer on a pandemic. That's inexcusable.
Costin says the U.S. public health system has been starved for funding and staff for years. It could not handle the load when the pandemic hit. But he and others place much of the blame on former President Donald Trump's administration.
It was a response that was not based on science, it was not well organized, and it did not communicate in a forthright way with the public.
Supposing we hit the body with a tremendous, whether it's ultraviolet or just very powerful light, and I think you said that hasn't been checked, but you're going to test it.
Promoting unreliable treatments, sidelining scientists, and politicizing basic prevention, experts accuse Trump of undermining America's response to the pandemic. Trump does get credit for investing in the fastest vaccine development in history, an effort starting to pay dividends. But since Joe Biden took over the presidency in January, top experts are visibly relieved.
And by comparison, this is night and day.
On day one, they released a plan. We didn't have a plan for a whole year, and it was a good plan.
The idea that you can get up here and talk about what you know, what the evidence, what the science is, and know that's it. Let the science speak. It is somewhat of a liberating feeling.
But the science says there is a long way to go. Infection rates are down, but dangerous variants are spreading. Vaccines are rolling out, but getting shots is difficult and riddled with racial inequalities. Vaccine hesitancy is declining, but still worryingly high. The virus is not going away anytime soon, but Gostin says it will get more manageable.
We're going to have to be vigilant. It's not going to be over, but we're going to learn to live with COVID-19. And we'll live with it, you know, reasonably well.
1 year down, maybe more to go. But experts say they may not be as bad. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
If you have questions or comments about any of the stories in today's program, please connect with me on Twitter. I'm at It's Steve Miller. And still to come.
After the pandemic hit and restaurants began to suffer, Valles and other women in the industry organized a food festival called Regarding Her, or Re-Her.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
If you struggle with being obese or overweight, you know just how difficult it can be to lose the pounds needed to achieve and maintain a healthy body weight. Over the years, many desperate to lose pounds have tried diets, medications, and even surgical procedures. A large international team of scientists have reported promising results in their tests of a new drug called semaglutide. Almost 2,000 people from 16 countries participated in the tests. Test results published in the New England Journal of Medicine show that 3/4 of those who received doses of the new drug lost more than 10% of their body weight, while 1/3 of them lost more than 20%. The study authors call the drug a game changer and suggest there hasn't been any other drug that has come as close to providing this level of weight loss. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. International Women's Day on March 8th celebrated women's achievements and highlights issues of women's rights. To mark the occasion, the U.S. State Department presented the International Women of Courage Award, and VOA spoke with a recipient. VOA's Arash Arabasadi takes it from here.
In cities like Paris, Madrid, and around the world Monday, people gathered in person and online for the annual observance of International Women's Day. Riders at this rally in Mumbai celebrated the occasion on motorbikes, saying that the day serves as a reminder that women are not to be taken for granted. But this year's celebration comes amid turmoil in countries like Myanmar. The UN says more than 50 people there are dead as of Monday, the victims of violence following a coup and the arrest of de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Fiofio Aung is co-founder of the Wings Institute for Reconciliation, an organization that aims to bring young people together to bridge cultural and religious differences. She is a recipient of this year's International Women of Courage Award and is considered an emerging leader in Myanmar. She spoke with Voice of America.
It is a time of dramatic change in my country. There are women leaders from all walks of life who courageously joined the anti-coup movement. I feel awkward, uncomfortable, and sad to receive this award in this difficult time. Even though I do not deserve this award compared to those who sacrifice most, I am accepting it on behalf of all courageous women who fight for democracy and freedom for our country.
First Lady of the United States, Jill Biden, spoke Monday at the State Department's Women of Courage virtual observance.
These women made an extraordinary choice to persist, to demand justice, to believe that despite the obstacles and fear that they faced, that there is a future worth fighting for.
President Joe Biden marked the day by signing two executive orders. One establishes a gender policy council, and the other takes aim at sexual assault on college campuses. Monday marks the 15th year of the International Women of Courage Award presented by the U.S. Secretary of State. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Thousands of women joined protests by farmers on the outskirts of Delhi on Monday to mark International Women's Day. Together, they demanded the scrapping of new laws that open up agriculture produce markets to private buyers. Reuters' Libby Hogan has that part of the story.
Activist Sudesh Goyat said the protests were not just about improving the rights of farmers, but the first time that women from rural areas were able to showcase and highlight the contribution of female farmers. This shows women have power, women who work as laborers, who are from an agricultural background. Even women from military households have power. This maternal force has awakened for their rights. This protest will change history. Since December, many farmers, accompanied by their families, have camped at three sites on the outskirts of Delhi. They fear the reforms will leave them at the mercy of big corporate buyers and end the practice of assured government purchases. But the government says the reforms will bring private investment into a vast and neglected farm sector, improve supply chains, and cut colossal waste. Faced with the protests, Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government offered to suspend the laws for 18 months, but the farmers have refused to back down. They say they won't give in until their demands are met.
Libby Hogan reports for Reuters News. A new all-female Los Angeles, California organization called Regarding Her is creating a growing network of female chefs and restaurateurs to support one another. Ginia DeLow has that story.
Brittany Valles has been in the restaurant business since she was 18. She went from waiting tables to being a cafe manager to transforming her simple taco stand called Gorilla Tacos into a high-end Los Angeles restaurant. She later found it was helpful to keep in touch with other women in the business.
Not having an ally to get advice from was difficult in the beginning, but that every year there are more women in our industry, more chefs, more operators, and it makes it so much easier.
After the pandemic hit and restaurants began to suffer, Valles and other women in the industry organized a food festival called Regarding Her, or Re-Her. Over the course of 10 days, more than 100 women who owned restaurants in Los Angeles advertised and promoted each other's venues. They even offered dishes from the menus of their so-called sister restaurants.
We're all going through a lot, women in particular, especially if you're a mom. I mean, those are a lot of big choices that people have to make, you know, if there's a lack of childcare, for example, and moms are having to stay home and mother their children, school their children, and on top of that, try to run their businesses.
Next, regarding her plans to hold a fundraiser so the organization can provide grants to female-owned restaurants in Los Angeles. Members say the goal is simple, to provide financial help condition-free.
There is a moment now with the pandemic where you have to look for your strength. And we saw that in her gathering all these women, that there was some vital energy that we all needed to feed off of because we were all having such a tough time. So, and there's this female,
it was like female camaraderie.
That is, you know, where you realize that you're all in the same boat together.
Regarding her, members also offer each other coaching and mentoring as they look for support during these trying times. Jenny Adulo for VOA News, Los Angeles, California.
And finally, American broadcaster CBS aired Oprah Winfrey's interview with Prince Harry and Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex, on Sunday. The interview revealed a lot of sordid and intimate details about the couple's relationship with the royal family and the palace. AP correspondent Julie Walker has more.
Prince Harry says the royal family welcomed Meghan, but things changed after their Australia tour.
My biggest concern was history repeating itself.
An apparent reference to his mother, Princess Diana. Harry did not criticize his brother, William, but said time heals all things and says he's working to repair relations with their father, Prince Charles.
I feel really let down.
Meghan says she never made Kate cry, and it was the opposite.
A few days before the wedding, she was upset about something pertaining to, yes, the issue was correct about flower girl dresses, and it made me cry.
Meghan also revealed she had suicidal thoughts and that the palace discussed how dark their child's skin might be. The couple say the baby on the way now is a girl. That interview, courtesy Harpo Productions, CBS. I'm Julie Walker.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Marking the 7th anniversary of Russia's invasion and seizure of Crimea, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken affirmed in a statement this basic truth: Crimea is Ukraine. Russia's occupation and increasing militarization of the Crimean Peninsula have implications far beyond Ukraine's borders, threatening the world's common security, noted Secretary Blinken. Indeed, the occupation comes at significant human cost. Russian occupation authorities have sustained a brutal campaign of repression against Crimean Tatars, ethnic Ukrainians, and members of other minority ethnic and religious groups in Crimea. Russian authorities have raided mosques and homes, expelled independent media off the peninsula, and handed down lengthy prison sentences to those who dare to speak out against the occupation. Russia's repression has left Crimean residents in a constant state of fear, unable to live their lives freely. Secretary Blinken called on Russia to immediately end its occupation of Crimea, release all Ukrainian political prisoners it unjustly holds, and return full control of the peninsula to Ukraine, and likewise called on Russia to end its aggression in eastern Ukraine. U.S. sanctions on Russia in response to its aggression in eastern Ukraine and seizure of Crimea will remain in place unless and until Russia reverses course, stressed Secretary Blinken. The United States does not and never will recognize Russia's purported annexation of Crimea. The United States welcomes Ukraine's new initiative, the Crimean Platform, which aims to improve the efficiency of the international response to the occupation of Crimea, respond to growing security challenges, step up international pressure on Russia, prevent further human rights violations, protect victims of the occupying power, end Russia's occupation of Crimea, and return full control of the peninsula to Ukraine. The Crimean platform will be launched officially at an inaugural summit in Kiev on August 23, 2021. The United States looks forward to continuing to work with Ukraine and its allies and partners to end Russia's occupation of the Crimean Peninsula and its aggression in eastern Ukraine.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.